Good morning and welcome. Welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning when we're going to be talking about the Onondaga County Justice Center and also other issues of detention from the president of the American Jail Association. Just again, a heads up, we have three more sessions that will run through the end of April with our program, so you won't want to miss those. Next week, we'll be talking about gay marriage and the religious right. The following week, we'll have the Ivory Tower Hour, and then we will end up with a representative from America's Edge talking about the skills gap, or is there a skills gap in Central New York? So that, of course, ties into our OCL study. I also want to remind you, you should have received a notice and invitation to an event on April 14th, which is the release of the last OCL study on early childhood, Thrive by Five. That event is on April 14th, and the deadline for responding is coming up in a couple of days. So let us know if you would like to come to that event, which will be a sort of a mini conference and kind of a celebration. And we will also be honoring Peggy Lietzi with an award on behalf of all of the work that she has done for early childhood. So we're looking forward to that, Peggy. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Susan Fertney. Susan is one of our newest TMR members to come up and introduce today's guest speaker. Susan is the Executive Director for Community Engagement and Primary Care Administration at St. Joseph's Hospital. Thanks.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Mr. Esteban Gonzalez. He's a chief custody deputy for the Onondaga County Sheriff's Office in Syracuse, a 671-bed supervision correctional facility with a staff of approximately 290. He's also president of the American Jail Association and a certified master instructor for the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services. Mr. Gonzalez travels nationally as a corrections training consultant and has authored numerous articles published in the Corrections Manager's Report and American Jails Magazine. In 2013, he appeared in the Wall Street Journal and on Fox News, speaking on how U.S. jails are becoming the largest mental health institutions in our nation. In January of this year, he testified before the Congressional Prison Rape Elimination Act Review Panel to provide a national perspective on sexual victimization in jails. Mr. Gonzalez holds a Bachelor's of Arts from Columbia College. In addition to his corrections work, he is a certified trainer for Dale Carnegie of Central New York, a franchise of Dale Carnegie and Associates, a global training and development corporation with over 100 years in business and international offices in over 80 countries worldwide. Mr. Gonzalez also serves as a guest lecturer at Columbia College, and in his spare time, he gives back to the community by serving on the board of directors for Leadership Greater Syracuse and assisting with the New York State Special Olympics Winter Games. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Esteban Gonzalez.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thrilled to see everybody here. I'm very, very excited to be here today. And I need your permission. I'd like to tell you what I like to do, and you have to agree to it, or else we've got to change the format, okay? All right. So this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to tell you a little history, a little bit about where we came from, a little bit about the old jail, where we are today, and a little bit about some national corrections issues. Can we do that? The other thing I need you to do, I see a lot of familiar faces in the room. I tend to talk a lot. So when it gets to that witching hour, the 30 minutes, throw a rock at me, tell me to shut up. You know, I know some of you will do that, so please do that for me. I can go on and on. So I'd like to start by telling you a little story. Back in 19, can you hear me or am I too loud on this? Back in 1994, there was a young gentleman, he was 26 years old, in the public safety building jail, he heard a Code Orange called out. Code Orange is a fight between inmates, could be numerous inmates. So this individual, not paying attention to his training, ran into the housing block that was overcrowded, had about 100 inmates on the second floor, affectionately known as the Deuce in the old jail, and ran into the block and saw a pile of inmates all fighting with each other, probably about 8 to 10. And you couldn't tell where one body started and one ended. They were biting each other, kicking each other, fighting on the ground. And what do you think this individual did? He dove into that pile of bodies because that's all that this individual could think to do, to try to disperse the bodies. Now, that's brilliant. With no backup, with no radio on, just ran in and hit the bodies. That didn't work out quite that well for that individual because while a few of them started fighting, one got up and bit the individual in the side of the body, and another one got up and got him in a headlock. So this individual was starting to lose the battle because he went in without backup. And at the same time, listen what was happening in the back of the block. This individual's field training officer, who is the individual who shows a new officer what to do, teaches him the rights and wrongs and how to be an officer, was in the back of the block and was filling up a mop bucket and was not coming in to help this young officer who was in dire need of emergency assistance. When two people came back there and saw this individual filling up the mop bucket, they said, "Hey, that individual in there needs your help. What are you doing back here?" They report that that FTO pulled out his ring of keys, you know, the big skeleton keys that they have in the old jails. He pulled that out, and he was so scared that he couldn't get the key in the keyhole. He's going ting, 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 knock it all around the key. He finally, they yanked the keys away from him. They open up the door, and those individuals come in and save this young man's life, who was going down quickly because he did not know how to fight off 10 people. How do you think it ended for that individual? Eventually, that individual did get promoted. It didn't end well that day. He got disciplined for several violations, and I've got the scar to prove the bite on the side of my body that I was that ignorant young man who did not know what he was doing. So given that, I'd like to say, but how did we get there? That was 1994, remember? That was on the precipice of us opening the Justice Center jail. How did we get to that point? And I'm sure all of you know a lot of what I'm about to tell you. In the 80s, and often before that, we went through stages of massive overcrowding, massive overtime runs, just no place to put bodies. The mental health comment that was in my bio, that's not new. We all know that mental health institutions closed down 30, 40 years ago, and then over the years, we did become the de facto institution. So it's not news. But in the 1980s, we started opening up housing units, annexes up to the Jamesville Correctional Facility, and we were in trouble. The pivotal point happened, and this is not a proud time in our history, but it's the truth, and it needs to be said. In 1987, the landmark case locally, Albro versus Dillon, then Sheriff John Dillon, happened. It was a Syracuse law professor and some Syracuse law students got together and started an investigation in the Justice Center jail. And Judge Munson, the federal judge at the time, decreed that we needed to build a Justice Center jail. We needed to do something differently. So with all of that in our back pocket, we started a transition team, and then Chief, well, he was a lieutenant at the time, Tony Callisto, a member of TMR. He's now the Chief of Public Safety up to Syracuse University. He led a transition team around the country, visiting jails from Colorado to Massachusetts to Virginia, and gleaned the best architectural designs, the best ideas in management that they could find, and brought that back here to Syracuse. The turning point happened, a great thing happened and a bad thing happened in 1992. The great thing that happened was that we broke ground on the building of the Justice Center. The bad thing that happened, I don't know if any of you recall, was the airing of the 60 Minutes video that was timely. It was called Cell Block 3B. that showed that, boy, did we need a new jail in Onondaga County. So with that, we started a three-year process. We built our Justice Center jail. And in the 3 years, we had some setbacks. We had some overruns. But in 1995, May of 1995, we opened up our jail. Now, how many of you have had a tour, have been in the jail? I'm not talking about inmates. I'm talking, you've seen what the jail is. You don't have to disclose that if you were an inmate. That's okay. Good. So there's a number of people here that know what I'm about to talk about. Our jail is a 10-story high-rise building right in downtown Syracuse. That is a direct supervision facility. Does everybody know what direct supervision is? All right. Direct supervision has been around since 1974. It's a long time, right? It started in the federal system. The Federal Bureau of Prisons started this model. Now, this is going to sound crazy to some of you, because think about what I'm about to tell you. This direct supervision is when you put an officer, so say all of you look around the room at each other, about this many people, you're all in a room, and the cells in the housing unit are on the perimeter, on the outside of the housing unit. But all during the day and night, the inmates are allowed to wander around in direct supervision. The officer has a desk in that housing unit with no barriers, no bars, nothing between him or her and the inmate population, thus directly supervising the inmate population. Now, does that sound nuts to some of you? It does, doesn't it? You think, well, that's kind of dangerous. How can you protect yourself? Well, we found that it's not nuts and that it is very, very safe. In fact, it's the safest jail management model in the country based on all stats from the federal government on down. We can't claim credit for that great idea, though. Community policing started before direct supervision did. You know that model where there'll be a crime-ridden neighborhood in some community, and they take the officer, and they put that officer on that beat in that neighborhood so that they will walk around, get to know the constituency, find out what crimes have been committed, what may be committed, and be proactive. That's exactly what we're talking about inside direct supervision in a jail. You put the officer into the housing unit, and that officer's standing right there. So if I'm standing here, are you going to attack him? Are you going to beat her up? Are you going to steal that one's commissary? The answer is no. You might want to turn my back, but most of the time, all the crime, all the violence does not occur because the officer is standing right there. So that's the model of direct supervision. So with that, we started on a journey. We didn't know how it was going to work out. What do you think happened when we first moved into the jail? I just described the model of direct supervision, but what about emergencies? Tell me what you think about emergencies. So say a big fight happened in one of the housing units. How do you think we responded to that? We did get them back all in their cells. We called for help and all that, but you know what we found out really quickly was we needed a organized emergency response team. Thus was born the Sheriff's Emergency Response Team. Because I know from personal experience in the old jail where I started, it was exactly this. It was a pile-on. So if there was an inmate that was fighting with another inmate or a staff member in the cell in the old jail, all of the staff would just hear the call for help on the radio, and in a small cell, and when I say small, I'm talking small, probably about this big, those cells, you saw them on 60 Minutes, probably about that big, the bunks here, the toilets there. You have 10, 12 staff members piling in trying to stop that fight. You think people got injured? Yeah. Staff more often got way more hurt than inmates did because you couldn't help yourself. Everybody's piled up on top of each other. So when we opened up our jail, we decided we need an emergency response team. We need to be able to have better supervision. We need better medical and mental health staff. In the old jail, we had 100 inmates at any given time on a floor that was set up for 46 inmates. So we were over double capacity. We were a 212-bed jail. When we left and moved in 1995, we were around 400 inmates, nearly double our capacity. So we needed to make that move. So I've told you a little bit about direct supervision, about the structure of it. Again, if you haven't been downtown, please come to our jail. It's two stories, two floors, five floors, 10 stories high. It is 24/7. Does everybody understand the difference between Jamesville and our facility? Because a lot of people I talk to say, oh, I don't get that. I'll explain that. Does everybody understand the difference between a jail and a prison? Most people do. Oh, jail is pre-sentenced, prison is sentenced. Believe it or not, a lot of people I talk to say that's synonymous. That jail is prison. You're saying the same thing. I go, no, we're not. The jail in downtown Syracuse is run by Sheriff Kevin Walsh, soon to be a new sheriff elected. There's an election in November. Get out and vote. Sheriff Walsh runs our pre-sentence facility of 671. The Jamesville sentenced facility is for people that are serving local time for misdemeanor crimes 1 year or less. Here, if you get a felony conviction of 1 year or more, typically you will go to state prison. And Jamesville is sentenced under Commissioner Timothy Cowan, who I hear, lucky us, because I'm a member too, he's coming here in the fall to speak to us about Jamesville. So he runs that facility, and he serves under the county executive's office, where I serve under Sheriff Walsh. So that's the difference there. So that's how we're all set up. Where are we today with our Justice Center jail? We're at an exciting time right now. Did anybody see the Jim Kenyon piece recently that was on the news, where they toured our jail and talked a little bit about the stuff that's going on inside the jail today? There's some exciting stuff going on. Let me start right off by telling you we turned a massive corner with the outstanding work that's being done with the medical and mental health unit or company that took over. As you know, we went from county-run medical and mental health from the opening of the Justice Center until 2010. 2010, we privatized. We went out to correctional medical care, and we learned our lesson, and we did not re-up that contract. They were not what we thought they were going to be, and we have moved on, and we now have Correct Care Solutions, CCS, and they're doing an outstanding job. The good news here is that they are opening an infirmary, knock on wood, by May in the Justice Center on the fifth floor. That infirmary is an elevated level of medical care so that not only do inmates not have to go out as often, the care that they'll get when they stay in will be that much better. I'm talking about wound vac and sutures and running IV and PICC lines, all of that stuff where before it just wasn't done. So that level of care has gone through the roof. Mental health care, we've done two National Institute of Corrections studies on mental health care. We had doctors come in, look at our facility, and they told us, you know what? That mental health unit is antiquated. They said, if you think glass walls with an individual who is already scared of his or her surroundings, with the echoey noise that's going on in here, with all the inmates all around screaming and yelling in this mental health unit, if you think that's conducive to correcting or improving their behavior, you're wrong. So we put together a big, large report, and we are still hopeful that the mental health unit will come to pass, and then that will be in the near future of the Justice Center, that we will add to that. The other great thing that's going on right now is that we have 24 educational programs, 24 educational programs going on inside our jail. And I know a lot of you will say, well, it's only a temporary holding facility. Why are you doing that? It's true. Our average length of stay is only 22 days. But we are working closely with the prison system, closely with Jamesville, so we start the individuals on their GED programming. But we also have anger management, men's and women's issues. We have small engine repair. We have literally resume writing, quilting. We have OSHA classes that are going on. How about flagging? You know what I'm talking about when I say flagging? On a construction site, you see the person with the orange flag. We said even that, we're going to have a class for that. And they said, but wait a minute, that costs $600. When I get out of jail, I don't have $600 to pay for that OSHA course. So we said, we'll give you the course here in the Justice Center. You do not have to pay. We will absorb that cost, and then we will send you through the the flagging course, and now we have inmates that are going out into the community getting jobs as flaggers on construction sites. 24 courses. And when anybody comes to the jail and says to me, Chief Gonzalez, why are you doing that? I say, why not? If not us, then who? And you get everybody, I hope we have a healthy debate after this. I want a lot of questions. Some people will be very conservative. Some people will be on the liberal side. And I say, if not us, then who? It doesn't matter if they had a breakdown in their family unit. It doesn't matter if they were in a gang. It doesn't matter what neighborhood they live in. What matters is that they're in our jail. We need to take care of them the best they can. And they're innocent until proven guilty in a pre-sentence facility. I hammer that into everybody's head that comes in my jail. That's the people's jail. It's in the Constitution. So I don't care if they have a rap sheet of papers that's this high. They're innocent in that jail. And that's what we have to get across to everybody that comes in our jail. So, yes, programming is very, very, very important to all of us there. The last thing I want to say with regards to that, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the future, is I'm proud that this facility that came from the history that I talked about, the public safety building jail to the Justice Center now, has become a model for jails around the country. The National Institute of Corrections sends tours to Syracuse of people looking to see how to open up a direct supervision jail. We just hosted internationally groups from Toronto, Canada, and Windsor. They came down and they shadowed and spent 2 days in our jail and our housing units running around figuring out how to run direct supervision. So the model of management that we are doing currently here in Syracuse, New York, is sweeping across Canada right now. In fact, next week, I'm flying out on Sunday, I am speaking on a panel on a symposium in Toronto. All of the provinces will be represented there. They want to mimic and model what we're doing here in Syracuse, New York, in their jails because they see, as well as we do, that this is the way to go. So we are on the precipice of great things. Now, where does this jail rank nationally? I know you heard that they said, I'm coming to the end of my term. It was good and it was busy. In a few weeks, I turn over the presidency of the American Jail Association in Dallas to a woman from California. What have I seen in my travels? I've seen great jails and I've seen horrendous jails. I've seen progressive ones and I've seen ones that you would not believe still exist here in these United States. And that's the sad, sad fact. What I want to do is be the leader of showing what the rest of the nation what is possible in jails. There are some jails that I visited in Atlanta, Georgia, and some of the suburbs there. Their transportation is also the fire department, where the fire truck, the bucket that the gentleman will stand in and squirt the hose out of and put the fire out, that's got the metal ring around the top of the bucket, that fire truck will go to the local county jail, pick up the inmates. The staff will handcuff the inmates to the ring around the bucket, and then the officer and the inmate will ride in that fire truck bucket to the justice court, get out, and go there. While the fire truck sits there waiting, running, idling on the curb for them to get done with justice court. That's just one of many stories that I could tell you of stuff that I've seen. I saw, and I'm afraid to even mention the state, so I won't, in southern the United States, where I was on a tour, and there was a big wooden door in the front of this unit, and I saw the staff bring the inmate up with, the individual had toiletries, towel, soap, toothbrush, and all that, and they said, here, now go in there and find a bunk. They opened up this archaic-looking, thick, medieval door, and they said, go on in there, and I said, who's going to go in there to make sure the individual gets a bunk, first and foremost, that he's okay? And they're like, what are you, crazy? We don't go in there. And I was like, what do you mean you don't go in there? They're like, we don't go in there. They're like, we have certain inmates that we know that will keep it calm, keep control in the housing unit, and they'll let us know if there's an emergency that we need to go in for, or if, you know, God willing, if there's a body that we have to go get. That was 3 years ago in these United States, southern United States. So what I'm telling you is, I look around me and I can't run to the airport quick enough to get out of these places when I see things like this going on. It's an exciting time to come back to Syracuse and realize we have great things going on. And finally, there are three big issues, and then I'll open it up to whatever anybody wants to ask me. Three big issues on the national front, and I'm sure you guys all know this. The first one is the Prison Rape Elimination Act. You're all aware of that law that came out in 2003. It was enacted in 2003 in order to stop prison rape, to stop rape and victimization in our jails, actually in our prisons. And this is where I don't understand the ideology of some people that are running our jails and prisons in the country, because the literal language of the law said it was binding on the Federal Bureau of Prisons in some of my travels. Not, thankfully, this was in Colorado. This was not in New York State. I heard some jail administrators saying, well, then the hell with that. I'm not complying with that. That's the Federal Bureau of Prisons mandate. We don't have to comply with that. And I said, do you hear what you're saying? You run a jail in these United States. I don't care, jail, prison, juvenile facility, where you're taking somebody's freedom away, and there's a law that says we all need to come together and stop rape and victimization from happening, and you're going to say publicly you're against it. That's not the brightest thing. I think I'd keep my mouth shut if I were you. I've told people this, and while it's true that it's not directly binding on jails, it is financially binding, and it's the right thing to do. You can lose, through the governor's office, some funding. You can lose the ability to take in inmates if your facility is not PREA compliant under this law. So there's many, many damages that can occur in your facility if you don't comply. So please, if any of you hear that, I want to let you know this jail in Syracuse and the Jamesville facility are PREA compliant. We're going to continue to be PREA compliant. The only issue that we have is the law as it's written, the national law, says that we have to have 18-year-olds separated. 18-year-olds separated from the rest of the population. The reason why that works in the rest of the nation is because 18-year-olds on down in everywhere except North Carolina and New York are in the facilities, the adult facilities like we have. So there is no place to put the 18-year-olds segregated currently in our facilities in any of the jails in New York. We right now have a prospective law in Albany asking the law to be changed in order to comply with the PREA, so stay tuned for that. The second biggest thing we have going on nationally is the calling rates. There was a big move afoot several years ago for a group in Washington that was saying that certain jails and prisons around the country, the phone companies were charging too much money for the inmates to call their loved ones. And I agree. I absolutely agree. That was something that needed to be looked at. So based upon that, a big study was done. The FCC had many public hearings. They've published comment in their Federal Register. I went down to Washington. I spoke on some panels. We did a lot of work. And what happened was there were some safe harbor rates that were mandated that for interstate calls going from out of state, so New York down to Virginia to Massachusetts, those are mandated, and they can only be a certain amount of money. So no matter what it costs the phone company, they cannot recoup their costs. They cannot put that additional cost on the backs of the inmates or the inmates' families. So that was a needed change that had to happen. The only thing that myself and a few other, not a few other, many, many agencies around the country are worried about is that they're not going to allow you to have enough revenue to come in order to preserve the phone system that helps us also prevent crime going on in the facility. Because a lot of what's going on in the facility, sometimes, I don't know if a lot of you know this, phone calls in the facility are monitored. There's an automated message on the phone that says this call is being monitored for security purposes, and crimes are committed more often than you'd think. Calls are made from the housing units out to the community, and you name it, we have heard it on these phone lines. So our ability to keep the public safe is critical, that we need to have those phone systems operating. So that's another one that we're currently working on. And the last one is, I know you've heard this. It was in the New York Times. How about the word isolation? Have you heard that? It's huge, isn't it? I want to let you know that does not happen and Syracuse. I want you to please commit this to memory. There'll be a test at the end, all right? There'll be a test. There's a difference between disciplinary segregation and isolation. And there's a difference between being in disciplinary segregation with people in the cell right next to you. You can yell out the window. Staff's going through in 15-minute intervals. Nurses come in. Everybody, you're not alone. When I hear the word isolation, I think of movies I watched growing up, being thrown down a hole, some war movie. That's not what happens. But that's what was being presented on the national front. So we have resolutions locally and with the American Jail Association out there to say, to educate the public that disciplinary segregation is a necessary component for individuals who are dangerous to themselves, other inmates, and staff. Without that, how would you be able to control the institution? If you have nothing to be able to take away from an individual to punish them, if they're uncontrollable, they're attacking other individuals, you have to say, okay, well, we're going to lock you here, not alone in a hole, in a humane environment, but you won't have as many privileges in the direct supervision environment as the other people have, because other than that, what's the difference? What are you going to ask them to do that will change good behavior as opposed to bad behavior? So if you hear the word isolation is not happening, prisons, yes. Is isolation bad? Yes. You can quote me on that. Isolation, as it is strictly defined, is horrible for juveniles. It's horrible for adults. It's not conducive to mental health treatment. Leaving people alone for long periods of time actually it reverses the therapy and the treatment that they're so deserving of. So isolation does not occur in our facility. And that being said, that's where we are on the future front. So this first year or so, year and a half as chief, I've seen a lot of history. I've seen where we came from, where we are, and where we can go. There's some great, great things that are coming to this jail and to this community. We're going to partner with some colleges in the near future. We're going to partner with the DOCS prison system in order to make sure that we can educate people. And I'm not talking about necessarily college degrees, because trade school education is just as important. We have plumber apprentice programs in our jail. We're going to start tile setting and carpentry. These are things that the community needs that are so desperately not there that we are looking for the best way forward for the inmate population. So with that, I hear staff all the time saying to me, wait a minute, you're doing so much, Gonzalez, for the inmate population. What about us? It's horrible here. It's horrible for staff. You don't care about us. You don't know. You don't remember where you came from. You got a big office up in administration. Whoop-de-doo. I hear that all the time. So you know what I do? I pull out this piece of paper, and then I say, you think you've got it bad. I'd like to share something with you. And I would share this all with you. I do this all the time with them. This is from the American Police Beat magazine. And it says, ever wonder what a cop's job looked like about 200 years ago? And this is from, I want to know you trivia buffs out there, the first organized police force in modern times? London, yes. Sir Robert Peel, the Bobbies in London in the early 1800s. You win a prize. I don't know what it is, but you win a prize. Listen to this. This is the so to speak the recruitment poster for this time frame. There will be no meals eaten during the shift is the title. It says I want you for Peel's Police, 1839, and then it goes on shows the pay amounts. You must be aged between 23 and 40 years of age. Your working hours will be 8, 10, or 12 hour shifts, 7 days a week. So think about that. You didn't hear any days off, right? Every encouragement will be given to officers to grow beards, as shaving is regarded as unhealthy. However, beards must not exceed 2 inches in length. Your uniform will be worn all the time, and you served for life. So that meant you had one outfit for the rest of your life till you died. All the time to prevent accusations that you were spying on the public whilst in ordinary clothes. A duty band will be worn to indicate whether you are on duty or not. So that's how you figure out. You are not allowed to vote in elections. You must not gossip with the public. In particular, avoid conversations with female servants or other women on duty. Shame on you if you do. Do not walk or converse with your comrades. Merely exchange a word and pass on. Now listen to this one. This freaked me out because I of hearing people complain about the current working conditions. You will walk about 20 miles per shift. A marathon's only 26 miles, so you're walking almost a marathon 7 days a week, every day of your life. Come on. No rest days are allowed, and only 1 week holiday per year unpaid. Great. That's nice. No meal breaks are allowed. The top hat that you will be wearing could be used to hold a snack. So you got to carry your food around on your head inside your top hat. Hey, that's some great working conditions. You must inform the superintendent before you associate, eat, or drink with any civilians. Before attending for medical examination and interview to join the police, it is advisable to have a bath. I thought that was self-explanatory. Wash before you go see somebody, but, you know, foolish me. You are not allowed to sit down in public houses at any time. And this is the best one, the last one. You must expect a hostile reception from all sections of the public and be prepared to be assaulted, stoned, or stabbed in the course of your duties. So this is a public setting. I'd like to say is, before we close it up and go to questions, please don't assault, stone, or stab me. I'd much rather just answer your questions. Is that okay?
You got it.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Since we were talking about the deputies, what is the starting salary for a custody deputy?
Good
is
question.
It the same as a road deputy? And what range are we talking about?
It's never exactly the same. Great question. It's never exactly the same because there's separate contracts. In 1994, the union split. The police union is the OXBA. The police union's OXBA. The deputies in the jail are represented by the DSBA. So they're close, but as each contract gets ratified and put into place, right now the starting salary of a deputy in the jail is in the 30,000 range, mid 30,000. Don't quote me on that. I know that they max out around $50,000. And everybody knows, though, that that's the base salary. You've seen the paper, the articles in the paper where some people will live, and I know some of them personally, that will live in the jail doing double shifts, and they'll make over $100,000 a year. And I'm like, how can you do that? And then they come crying to me, some of them directly to my office, and say, can you help me out? My kids don't know me, and my wife called the cops when I came home because she didn't recognize me. I'm like, you're never there. So she thought you were an intruder. So that's about – are they the same? Right now, I don't believe they're exactly the same, but they're close. They're close.
First of all, I'd like to is it on?
Just ask a question, okay?
I want to first congratulate you as a graduate of Dale Carnegie. You did a marvelous job.
Thank you.
The question that I have is you did not mention anything about a fourth another jail.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to many of us that there is really no need for the jail. What is needed is a new way to put people to, after people are arrested, how to handle them.
Yep.
That speaks to bail for, why is there bail for people that you know are really not going to run?
Mm-hmm.
And that 22 days, that's not bad, but it also means that there are people there for 60 days or 80 days or 100 days.
Absolutely there, yeah. I love your question about what we should do to not have them come into the jail in the first place. We have crisis intervention teams right now. That move is afoot nationally, and we've latched on to that here for mental health individuals in the community. We've worked with the Syracuse City Police, the Department of Mental Health in Onondaga County, and CPEP, where we will divert individuals from even coming into the Justice Center jail who are not appropriate. Now, obviously, if an individual is so violent and they've committed such a crime that they need to just be stabilized on the spot, that for public safety, we need to stabilize them on the spot, then we will do that. We will not leave them alone. They will be under constant observation. But once they're stabilized, we will ask to have them transported to CPEP or another appropriate facility to say, let's do an evaluation on this individual. Jail is not the place for this individual. I speak from personal experience. My son is autistic. He does not speak at all. And I have other friends in the community when I talk to them. God forbid I pass away and he got involved in the system. That terrifies me to think somebody like him getting arrested and not being able to say, I'm afraid. I'm not attacking you, officer, because I'm against law enforcement. I'm afraid because I don't know what you're doing. I don't have the mental capacity to understand why you're yelling at me, why these lights are blaring and the noise is so loud, telling me to get on the ground. You're scaring me. I have absolute compassion for that. We are working collaboratively to figure out what we need to do to not have people come to jail. And if they are there, treat them humanely and educate them so that they don't come back. And everybody says, well, show me the stats on that. With 10,407 admissions last year, people say, what if only 5 or 6 don't come back? And I say, I'll take that recidivism rate because those 5 or 6 are 5 or 6 less crimes that will be committed in our community. And that's important to me. Public safety is important to me.
Could you talk just a little bit about how you keep the facility itself secure, specifically related to gang activity and
sure.
drugs?
Great question. Specifically with gang activity, the phone system I just mentioned, we have, in conjunction with the road patrol, we have an intelligence unit right in the administration offices in the Justice Center, and the phone systems are monitored by a few different individuals, and we listen to the phone calls. So, and it's an art. I actually sat in on some Spanish-speaking wire investigations years ago. It's an art. It's hard to figure out some of the calls that are being made because they have so many code words for drugs and guns and everything like that. They'll use, say, like dolls or pairs of pants, and they'll say it so quickly, and they will use those drug messages to their grandmother and their grandfather. So your guard, if you're not ready for it, will come down a little bit because you're thinking, oh, this is just one of those calls. So these individuals, my hat's off to them that monitor these calls, listen all the time, and they capture these calls. Now, if somebody was arrested and put in our jail, not just the DA's office, but all of the city police and the local village and police will call and ask for recordings of the phone system, and they will work in conjunction with other entities to figure out how to prosecute the crime if indeed there's enough evidence there to conduct an investigation and to move forward with the prosecution of the crime. So that's the reason why I was so vehement about saving that phone system, because that's key to solving the gang problem. Once the inmates are in jail, though, speaking about gangs, people say, how the heck can you have rival gangs in the jail together? The answer is, in direct supervision, we found that the gang members, typically in a pre-sentence facility, it's only 22 days, we talked about, they're going to want to be on their best behavior. Once they're in prison, that's different, but they know they still have their day in court in front of the judge, so they're going to lay down and do their time, stay away from each other. Oftentimes, also, it's not dangerous for staff. They have problems with each other from the street occasionally, but not with staff. So we monitor the gang activity in the housing units. We don't allow clothing that shows different gang colors. It's all the same. Any type of insignia they're not allowed to have. They can't use religious medallions in an obscene or inappropriate way, because there are some gangs that have asked to get together for that purpose. There's a lot of them. Gangs around the country have tried to do things for years. Has anyone heard of CONS? Church of the New Song. It started in the 1990s. They tried to get themselves recognized as a legitimate religious group. They're a gang in many states in the nation, so that they could congregate and do their gang activity under the guise of religion once a week. CONS, really? Church of the New Song? It took everybody to figure out how wild that acronym was. And they said that their meal was porterhouse steak and sherry wine was what they were mandated to have. So it took us a while, but we figured it out that wasn't legitimate. So, great question.
My concern is relative to the health and safety of the inmate population. Specifically, you did mention you had a child with autism, but specifically related to those who have mental health or disabilities, who are on prescription medications, who are not allowed to have their medications at the time that they normally take them, which obviously alters some of their behaviors. And obviously we've heard, you know, some of the many dire situations that are happening, especially with some people who have passed away in your jail. So my concern is, how are you rectifying that problem?
Great question. I share the exact same concerns with you. What I can tell you right now is in November of 2013, the new company CCS took over, and all of the what you just referred to about them not getting their medication, every last instance of somebody, if an allegation comes, is treated as absolute truth. We investigate every last instance. The current medical director, her name's Ruth Ann Raposa, is outstanding. I hope someday she can come here and speak. She has the same compassion that you and I have for life safety of mental health individuals. And we're doing a disservice by just saying mental health. All individuals, medical, mental health, safety is paramount. We have in place a system where the referrals are not ignored. The doctors and mental health providers see people immediately upon admission, and they're followed through. In fact, a case in point, last Friday, through the director, our probation department, Andy Sisherman, called me and said, I have a complaint from an inmate in there in your jail that said he's not being seen. I had Ruth Ann go and check on that individual. Not only was he seen immediately upon intake, he got his prescription medication. He was seen by the nurse practitioner, the doctor, and was already set for follow-up care this week on Monday. So anything that has been said in the past, I am saying, yes, errors have been made in the past. Yes, we need to understand our history and not repeat it. I can tell you from here forward, we have addressed and we will continue to address all inmates' needs, because, again, everybody needs to remain safe in our jail.
Would the legalization of marijuana have an impact on the demand for your services?
Great question. I'm not going to tell you what I think personally about that. Will it have a impact on services? Obviously it would. Obviously, we're talking about overcrowding right now and talking about a fourth tower that we've been in discussions in the public with that. Depending upon where it goes, and there's currently, correct me if I'm wrong, two states, is it Washington and Colorado, that currently have it. If that happens in New York State, we would probably have to figure out, how is it regulated? Is it regulated the same as alcohol? And what is the crime rate and crime report record? And what's arrestable and not arrestable? And what can you do and not do? But based on that, anytime you have a legalization and the ability to break laws in certain areas, that's going to increase the need for public service, thus the need for public safety and the need for jail cells. So let's wait, because the final chapter has not been written on that yet. Great question.
All right. You talk about overcrowding, and I know that there are a lot of different programs that are working at alternatives to incarceration, but I don't know if that means alternatives to pre-sentencing incarceration, so that would affect the Justice Center, or if that just means alternatives to prison for people who are convicted and then sentenced. So bottom line question is, alternatives to incarceration, would more of that help reduce the occupancy rate in the Justice Center?
It absolutely would. Our alternatives to incarceration program is primarily through the probation department, because we all know we don't want people to come into our jail in our community in the first place. We're saying alternative, something different than throwing people in jail. So right now there's huge move afoot to figure out how we can, without expending extra resources, because we know money is tight, bolster the probation department and figure out every last method in order to give everybody every opportunity without compromising public safety to get it right, to not have to come into the jail. So if it's a technical violation because of drug use, then instead of throwing them back into jail the way they used to in larger numbers, they will put them on home confinement and things of that nature. Now, obviously, we've heard horror stories about home confinement. We have to make sure that that part is kept as well. So there are many, many issues with alternatives to incarceration that are a key point in keeping the population down in our jails.
Is then just the one more question on that, the bail issue. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people are in the Justice Center because they cannot make bail.
Yep.
So are there programs that help people make bail?
Another great question. Here's the citizen in me that I get all up. I have to try to separate Chief Gonzalez from Esteban Gonzalez here. Bail is supposed to be for a threat to public safety or a flight risk. So I will not denigrate anybody publicly here, but I don't believe that's always the case with a bail that's set. I have my staff track. I have a reporting system called ComStat as computer statistics, started in New York City in the 1990s. We've adopted that here so that I can know every demographic, every stat in our jail. I even know which judges remand people to custody more often than others. So, yes, I know trends about who's on the bench, who's going to put people in jail. That being said, right now we work with jail ministry. Keith Siplicki took over for Bill Cuddy, great man. Unfortunately, they have limited funds. It's not what it used to be, but we will work collaboratively with them with a $1,000 bail or less. We get the inmates out that are on the second floor and third floor, the reception inmates, to every single day make a call. So if they can get their family member to front the $500, Keith Siplicki and company at jail ministry will do the other $500. We'll get them out. Even with $1,000 to $2,500, though, even that amount of money, we know that there'll be people in the community, have family members that can do that. We get all of those individuals out too, and my program staff will get them out every day to make phone calls. And a lot of my staff will say, that's redundant. We only get 2, 3, 4, or 5 people out. I'm like, if that was you, you'd want that phone call. You don't want to keep anybody in jail any more than they have to be. So we're doing up to $2,500 calls every single day to get them out. Above that, then that usually, anything above that, the judge usually has put a no bail, a detainer on them. They're a threat to safety, so we can't get them out.
Thank you.
Given the concern that you expressed about the jails and prisons becoming the mental health of mm-hmm. our future, can you comment on the fact that we're building 100 new cells for people who have psychiatric diagnoses in a pre-adjudicated mm-hmm. situation? And that's a forever thing in my lifetime and for peers that I'm aware of, that there's no alternatives to that. Can you talk
that's about that? I asked the exact same question, and the answer I got that was forthcoming was that you're barking up the wrong tree, Gonzalez. The ship sailed on reopening mental health institutions, redirecting money back that way in the 70s when the move was afoot for deinstitutionalization. What happened, though, was not enough money went to the outside resources, so inmates left institutions but then went to those outside resources, and there was nobody there to take care of them, to give them the medication. So they ultimately, like, who you don't need a PhD to figure this out, without the care that they needed, got into trouble again and got committed crime. I was told that the beds are not coming back in that model, in that way anymore, that we've got to look for a different way. Rather than wait for chaos to occur, rather than wait for more people's mental health to deteriorate in our jail, in an already overcrowded jail, we've decided that at least while they're with us, they'll still be safe. So while 100 beds sounds like a lot to you, even 200 beds might sound like a lot, we have trending statistics from 1995 when our average daily population was in the 400s. Today it's in the 600s. And we have trending populations, unfortunately, if it doesn't reverse, to say that it will be timely to build this, not just for mental health. We're just talking in general for overflow population. We're going to build it in such a way that it is unique enough so that we can house regular inmates and mental health inmates, any classification of inmate, in order to make the best use of those jail cells.
Do you make your service available to surrounding counties?
We absolutely do. How did you know that? You looked at my notes. We, as part of the legislature, challenged myself and Chief John Ballone to go visit all the surrounding counties. Oswego regularly boards out 25 inmates. They're crowded up there. So one of the things that we did when we said we wanted to consider a new mental health unit, they said, how are you going to pay for that? And we said, the extra beds that we have, not just if we don't fill up the unit. Remember, the new mental health unit would vacate the old mental health unit. So I said, all of our surrounding counties, we visited all the sheriffs directly and said, send us your general population inmates. A lot of them were trying to be slick. And they tried to say, can we send us, you guys are our hard inmates, the mental health inmates. And I was like, no. I want your general population inmates. We'll charge you $100 a day, thus offsetting the expense to that. So, yes, we are looking at that. We're looking at getting back the federal inmates that Tim Cowan had to get rid of because he had to take on our Justice Center inmates because our system collectively had no room. So, yeah, we are looking for revenue resource.
Do we have any more questions? We have one here.
You have 10,000 admissions a year?
It's down. It was 10,407 in 2013. It was 15,000 a decade ago.
How many people is that? Do you know the people? I mean, are they coming back again and again and again?
Oh, God, yes. Yes. So. God, yes. Yeah, I've seen a grandfather, father, and son in jail all at the same time. Yes.
How many people?
We do with what we can educationally, job-wise. We talked about alternatives to incarceration. Unfortunately, the stats show that there are some people who become institutionalized, and that just is the safety net where they want to go. It's no secret that it's a shame. It's a travesty to have homeless in any area in the United States. They're homeless here in Syracuse. It is a problem. Some people will commit crime in the cold weather just to come into our jail. There's a name, I'm not going to say it, but there was an individual that was arrested 200-plus times. He's passed away since, committing petty crimes in order to come back into the system. And he said it wasn't just because of the cold. It was because that's where he felt safe. That's where everybody knew his name, like George Went from Cheers, all that stuff. Everything, they become institutionalized. So although that's a sad fact, we cannot think like that. Most people don't want to be there. There will be a segment that will not react to education, will not react to programming, will still continue to commit crimes, which is why 10% of all new jails, unfortunately, still have to have a lockdown area because some people will not go along with the program. And we have to keep the public safe.
On any given day, what is the percentage of women versus men at the jail? And could you speak to the staffing of those women?
Yes. 10% in our jail is women. You know what we didn't do? We didn't, in 1995, consider the exploding women population and minor male population. So we've run out of room. I'm sure you all heard. That was a great question. We boarded out 8 females to Wayne County recently. They're back. So the legislature is happy now that we're not, and I am too. But we had to board out because when we built our jail, we decided, okay, for the adult male population, we have reception, we have the lockdown, we have mental health pods, we have minors and adults separated. We had all these areas. But for the females today in the jail, we've got a general population, that's 3C, and the mental health unit in 5B. So we don't, on any given day, typically, we run into the ceiling on that. Thankfully, again, knock on wood, our population has been low for the last quite a few weeks. But if it gets up too high, I will not violate any statutes of the New York State minimum standards. I will not violate law, and I will not be inhumane in our jail. So if it's a condition that we cannot tolerate, we will board out inmates. And I've told everybody that, and I've gotten people said to me, that costs money. Money doesn't matter when it has to do with human life and decency. So we will not allow inmates to sleep down in booking on those concrete slabs. I'm not saying that that didn't happen in the past. It's not happening on my watch. It will not happen. We are going to board everybody out if we have to. It's going to cost money, which is why I'm saying let's figure out a way to get extra bed space, maximize bed space, spend a little money to get a lot of money back. That's what we're looking for.
Amen. Thank you, Chief Gonzalez. Thanks.